Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined again by Dr. Tommy Wood. Hi, Tommy.
Hey, Chris.
Today we're going to talk about, before I go any further, I should mention, if you want to know more about Tommy, who he is, why he's an interesting guy to have on the podcast, go back and listen to my episode on hydration. We had a fantastic conversation. Looks like I'm starting again. Today I wanted to talk about something completely different, and it's something that's been sort of troubling me for some time, and it's the topic of oxidative stress. And so maybe I should start by defining what oxidative stress is, or at least what I've seen, and that's some markers on an organic acids urine test. So the way this test works is you just collect a sample of urine at home, and then you send the sample into the lab using a FedEx mailer, and then the result comes back to you electronically. And there's 46 different markers on this test, but there's two in particular that I'm interested to talk about today, and those are p-hydroxyphenol acetate and 8-hydroxy-2-deoguanosine. And so these metabolites, when they build up high in the urine sample, show that you're under a great deal of oxidative stress. And it makes sense in theory, I guess, to just take antioxidants to try and reduce this. Like, oxidative stress causes inflammation and inflammation causes oxidative stress. It doesn't sound like a good thing. And certainly there's lots of people out there selling supplements to, especially to athletes, to reduce oxidative stress. And the reason athletes are so likely to be affected is because you're just running metabolism more often, right? You're generating more energy, more free radicals, more oxidative stress. And you know, when I originally saw these markers years and years ago, I approached my uncle, who is an emeritus professor of pharmacology at Edinburgh University, and said, "Hey, what do you think about this? Is it quackery?" And he said, "No, it's real. Oxidative stress is a real problem. And I would suggest that you take or experiment with using, tomato paste, which has a very high lycopene content, to reduce your oxidative stress. And I think this is going to improve your health and longevity, and it's something you should really look at." And so that's what kind of got me started. And since then, like, I've seen opinions all over the map. So, you know, maybe I should ask someone that really knows what they're talking about, and that's where you fit in, Tommy. So why don't we start by defining what exactly is oxidative stress?
Okay, so oxidative stress, the reason that we call it oxidation, which sounds a lot like it's to do with oxygen, but it's not necessarily. So the when something becomes oxidized, what happens is that you have it's you've given it an electron or taken away an electron. So electrons like to come in pairs. So if anybody remembers, like, all the way back to basic science at school, they might remember those pictures of the elements, and you have those kind of like electrons that circle around the nucleus of your atom. Yeah?
Right, of course. So, yeah. So we've got an atom. I say of course. I've been doing, and this is like my top tip ever, if you want to understand biochemistry, go do the Khan Academy chemistry module. So I will link to this in the show notes, but you can Google it. If you just Google Khan Academy, it's spelled K-H-A-N Academy chemistry. And like, now you've got this organic acids test, you have a reason to care about this stuff. And so when you go redo the chemistry that you did in high school or maybe even college or something, it's all going to stick like glue. It's going to be so adhesive and so compelling to you. Like, I know it sounds kind of boring doing chemistry lessons, but this time around you're going to love it, and this is why. So you're talking about like the actual structure of like an atom, right?
Yeah, so in an atom, there are if you think about it in the traditional sense, there are sort of layers of electrons that circle around the outside,
right? So you've got this nucleus with protons and neutrons
in the middle,
and then on the outer shell, spinning around this nucleus, we have electrons.
Exactly. And then if you create a molecule, that could be anything. So say it's just a molecule of oxygen. So you have two oxygen molecules
stuck together. So there's nothing really complicated. We've used these words like atom and molecule, but there's not really anything super, well, I mean, obviously a lot of years and years of science and research, and it's still developing. That was one thing that surprised me. You know, I had this, you know, you've seen the sign, the symbol on the, in The Simpsons on the cooling tower at the power station that's got this neat model of an electron circulating around the nucleus. And we know now that that's not really correct and that the electron could appear in any place around the nucleus. It's just there's a higher probability of it appearing in one place rather than the other. So it's not quite correct. But yeah, we've introduced these fancy words, but that's all really we're talking about. So when you're talking about molecular oxygen, you're just talking about two atoms of oxygen stuck together.
Exactly. And then what happens is when you create a molecule like that, so that's more than one atom stuck together, and it could be a protein or an amino acid or a fat or whatever, and they start to share electrons, and that's what creates the bonds between them. And they will tend to come in pairs. And then what happens when you oxidize something is either you take away one of those electrons or an electron is donated to it. And the name for oxidation is usually to take away one of those electrons. But in general, if we say that something's oxidized, it could have been taken away or given. And so if you have a single electron that doesn't really have a partner, then you've created something called a free radical. And what happens is that can go on and react with other things, and that can damage proteins, damage DNA, damage the fats and the membranes of the cells. And so that's kind of what we tend to talk about if we're talking about oxidative stress. And if you're thinking about it, particularly in terms of exercise, then the major reactive oxygen species, and that's what we tend to be talking about, is these... free radicals or oxidizing molecules that are based around oxygen, so the oxidation is actually just almost a coincidence. They're something that's oxidized doesn't have to have oxygen in it, but the ones that we generate when we're sort of forming metabolism or we're doing exercise, the commonest one is superoxide, that we make superoxide, and superoxide is basically just a normal oxygen molecule with an extra electron kind of attached to it.
Okay, so you can think of it almost like a jealous friend, right? So it's this thing, it's like doesn't have enough electrons, it's looking for somewhere to steal another electron so it can be all happy and stable, and it will just grab that electron from whatever it sees. It's a bit like taking candy from a baby. And so if it takes that electron from, say, the phospholipid bilayer that surrounds the cell, then it seems feasible that if that were to happen often enough, then it might break the bilayer that surrounds the cell, and then something bad would happen to that cell, right?
Yeah, if the oxidative stress or damage is high enough, absolutely. And one of the first things when we were first discovering that exercise could induce oxidative damage was that in athletes they measured pentane, which they breathed out, and pentane is basically just becomes a byproduct of oxidative damage to fats in cell walls. So that was one of the first things that we saw, 40 or 50 years ago, when we were looking at what exercise can do in terms of generating reactive oxygen species.
Right. And there's so much research out there. It's not like a lot of people listening to this will have done the organics profile. And you won't really find anything if you search for organics profile or anything like that. The magic keywords you're looking for are the names of the organic acids. So if you search for 8-hydroxy-2-deoguanosine, PubMed, you will find tons of papers that describe this organic acid as a way to quantify oxidative stress. So this metabolite is actually a breakdown product of the guanine of DNA. So what this is telling you is the DNA, so the bit that actually instructs the cell on how to make proteins, has actually been destroyed in some way. And so the metabolite is building up in your urine. So this sounds like a really bad situation. So my next question is then, if this is bad, is less better?
So it really depends on the situation, and that's kind of, okay, I think where we're heading, and it's definitely It's definitely one of those things where originally, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we thought that reactive oxygen species were bad and that anything we could do to reduce them would be good, right? Because they, obviously, you know, by their nature, they are damaging. But we do have some processes by which we break down reactive oxygen species. So if you're generating superoxide again, so let's say this is during exercise, then it's generally converted into hydrogen peroxide by an enzyme called superoxide dismutase. And there's a version that sits inside the cell, inside the cytosol, like the main body of the cell. And there's also a version that sits inside the mitochondria. And then that hydrogen peroxide is converted to water by catalase or glutathione peroxidase. So people will have heard of glutathione, which is like a, it's three amino acids. It's glutamate, cysteine, and glycine, and two, and they're bound together. And then two glutathione molecules will take a hydrogen peroxide, and then it will sort of remove. It will donate in a hydrogen to create water, and then you'll stick those two glutathiones together, and then you recycle them. You have to use ATP, and you also get some help from vitamin E and vitamin C and potentially things like alpha lipoic acid. You can sort of recycle your glutathione. So that then just turns your superoxide into water, and then you obviously don't have any problem with it. But what we are seeing is, so you talk about 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine, and that is a potent marker of oxidative stress. And you can measure it in the urine, and that will give you an idea that your chronic oxidative stress burden is quite high, and it's causing direct damage to your DNA, because that's what you're measuring. Is you're measuring DNA breakdown products, and that is obviously a problem. And you know, we think that that sort of chronic high level oxidative stress increases the risk of type 2 diabetes, so it increases insulin resistance, it increases the risk of cancer. You know, there's a lot of potential chronic diseases that are associated with a high oxidative stress burden. But what we're sort of learning more about is that there's definitely, we need some reactive oxygen species. A chronic high level is bad, but peaks in reactive oxygen species are actually good. And they have a lot of benefit, you know, a lot of benefits that, you know, hopefully we'll talk about. So it's definitely not a case of that we just need to sort of get rid of them completely, because without reactive oxygen species, you know, we wouldn't, you know, cell signaling, you know, life essentially wouldn't happen. It's an incredibly important part of everyday signaling and reacting to the environment. It's one of the ways that we react to the environment and then, you know, come back, you know, better and stronger if we need to.
So this seems like a really common theme, doesn't it, in biochemistry and physiology, that you have this maybe a U-shaped curve, like a dose response type thing. And that was the quandary I got myself into quite quickly was, I could take the antioxidants and whether or not they reduce the oxidative stress, I'm not sure. But it seems certain that, you know, I need some, this is part of the mechanism by which we get stronger, right? So by taking the supplements, am I just squashing the benefits of, the potential adaptations that come from training and kind of almost negate like me training at all? Do you think that's true, or is it, again, it just depends how much oxidative stress you're under?
I think it could absolutely depend, and it will maybe also depend on the antioxidant that you're talking about and the situation that you're potentially taking it in. You know, so originally, you know, we saw that the harder you make somebody work on a treadmill, you know, the more oxidized glutathione they have, you know, so the more they're using up their glutathione stores. And that pretty much increases, you know, linearly with something like blood lactate. So, you know, the harder you're working somebody, the more glutathione they need to deal with all the reactive oxygen species they're making. And then if you give people, you know, some vitamin C or some extra glutathione, then you can dampen down those reactive oxygen species.
So they do work then? The water-soluble vitamins do work as antioxidants?
So they do work as antioxidants, and they absolutely increase your antioxidant capacity. But if you or somebody who's trying to, you know, get a performance benefit from training, then that's not necessarily a good thing. And so just because You know, so they do work. They will reduce oxidative stress. But what we're seeing more and more is that actually what you want from exercise is a certain amount of oxidative stress. And then if you dampen that down with various antioxidants, then you're actually removing that training benefit.
Okay. And so I've been accused in the past of providing a lot of information and not much prescriptive. So maybe I should take heed to that advice and start thinking about. So, you know, I recommend and I take personally the Thorn EXOS multivitamin, and it has antioxidants in it. So do you think the timing of those supplements is important? You know, I tended towards these days taking, you know, I work out in the afternoons and then I'll leave a gap of several hours before I take that supplement. And I'm not saying that this is the only reason I do that. Like it's more of a habit than anything else. But do you think that's a good idea? Would you try and space it out? Like if there's other nutrients in that multivitamin that I'm after, then do you think it makes sense to kind of space that out?
I think it would make sense in a such that you won't get, you know, your peak antioxidant levels won't sort of peak with your peak reactive, you know, your peak sort of oxidative burden from your exercise. So you could potentially be reducing a negative effect there. But you know, all of the studies, so say the antioxidants that are the most well studied probably and which you know people talk about a lot are vitamin C and vitamin E. And they tend to come together. So vitamin E, what it does is it will take the extra electron from something, from some kind of reactive oxygen species, say, and then it's recycled by vitamin C and glutathione. So they kind of work together, and there's a cycle there. So just having more of one on its own doesn't tend to have much of an effect. And actually, so they did one study about 10 years ago where they had Ironman triathletes, and they gave them just vitamin E and told them not to take vitamin C, or not take any extra vitamin C. And what they actually saw was an increase in lipid peroxidation. So they measured F2 isoprostanes in the blood and the urine, and they saw increased in inflammatory cytokines. So the proteins that sort of increase in response to inflammation and sort of activate the immune system. Interestingly, and I think maybe it was just because they measured just a short time after the race, they didn't see an increase in 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. They actually measured that and didn't really see a difference there. And that's after an Ironman triathlon. That's a huge oxidative burden. So that kind of, even though it's a long period of time, maybe just because it's a one-off and then the rest of the time they don't have that much, or they're recovering well, because, you know, this was at the Kona World Championships. So these are, you know, Ironman triathletes at the top of their game, so they'll have their recovery sorted. So then maybe they, you know, overall their levels of that kind of DNA damage are fairly low. But you know, in when they've looked at the studies giving vitamin C and vitamin E to people, what they've seen is that actually overall, maybe half of them don't really have any effect. So you're giving maybe 500 to 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day and 400 units of vitamin E a day. And both in resistance training and in endurance training, they don't really see any difference.
Okay, but there was that's a really, useful to know.
Yeah, but there was the thing is that there was a really good review paper by Petanel and Coombs in 2011, Sports Medicine Journal, if anybody wants to look it up. And they had, you know, they found over 150 studies of various antioxidants in exercise and looking at the potential sort of negative and positive effects. And what they talk about is the fact that most of these studies are in a very small number of people. You're talking about sometimes 5 people in the intervention group, you know, and when you're talking about statistics and actually trying to find something meaningful, you know, it's almost impossible to do that. So then if you're seeing a negative effect, it could be completely by chance. If you're seeing no effect, it could be that you don't have enough people to actually see that there's actually a negative effect there, because you need enough people and enough of a change to actually get some kind of difference. And this, you know, overall, what's useful is people are actually looking at performance. So, it, you know, what your you know, if you're trying to take antioxidants to boost performance, then what you want is a measure of performance. It's not necessarily blood levels of this or that, because right. that doesn't necessarily correlate with, you know, actual performance, say on the bike or, you know, when you're running. But there was a study, and it's probably one of the best ones that's been done, came out in PNAS in 2009, and they had 19 untrained men and 20 previously trained men. And the first half, they kind of did it like so that the participants knew what they were getting. And then the second half, it was like a placebo-controlled trial. And they got a gram of vitamin C a day and 400 units of vitamin E a day. And, you know, those are fairly standard doses. Those are fairly low doses. And then they were trained for five days a week. And so they were on a bike for 20 minutes, and then they did some circuit training. And what they saw is that in the antioxidant group, the antioxidants prevented an increase in insulin sensitivity, which you saw in the placebo group. So obviously one of the real benefits of exercise is you improve your insulin sensitivity. So they didn't see that in the intervention group. It also prevented an increase in adiponectin, which is a very important important signaling molecule in terms of like glucose metabolism and fatty acid metabolism. And it also prevented increases in some co-activators of transcription, which basically means that they activate making of proteins that kind of control various things in metabolism. And that's PGC1 alpha and PGC1 beta. And all of these things, what they do is they coordinate insulin sensitivity and they coordinate the improvement in reactive oxygen handling, reactive oxygen species handling, like increasing glutathione, increasing superoxide dismutase, increasing catalase. And actually, if you're taking antioxidants and you're not getting that sort of peak of oxidative damage or oxidative stress to do with exercise, then you don't get those benefits. And so you don't get that improvement in insulin sensitivity, and you don't get that improvement in your ability to handle oxidative stress.
Interesting.
And that's in one of the better studies, I think. And that's probably why it was published in PNAS, which is a very good journal, is because actually compared to a lot of the other studies that have been done, that, you know, they use some reasonably robust techniques and a reasonable number of people.
Right. So I've got two studies to link to here. I'll have to get the full reference from you so that I can link to that in the show notes. But yeah, it seems like, I mean, what you just described to me, those cyclists, I mean, 20 minutes, like it takes me 20 minutes to warm up, you know, it's like a totally different ballpark. And, you know, a couple of weekends ago, I did a 100-mile bike race off road, and I'm sure I looked the same. Obviously, I couldn't see how I looked. But when I looked at people at the finish line, you know, their eyes are bloodshot because they're so full of dust, and we're at, you know, 8,000 feet, and we've all been breathing God knows how much dirt. We're just, understanding like what causes oxidative stress. And it seems like it's generating energy for an athlete, and then inflammation are like the two things. So obviously that's going to be very different in a pro athlete that's just finished a 100-mile bike race than it is some, you know, college kid that you just recruited into your study to ride an exercise bike for 20 minutes. It's just like completely different scenarios.
And I think that's absolutely part of it. And interestingly, actually, the generation of reactive oxygen species doesn't seem to come from the generating of energy. Traditionally, we think about the fact that the complexes in the mitochondria, complex 1 and 3 of the electron transport chain, that's where a lot of reactive oxygen species are made, and that's completely normal. But actually during exercise, they seem to produce less superoxide, and more of it is produced by something called NADPH oxidase, which is an enzyme which sits on the cell surface. But there's also some associated with something called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And the sarcoplasmic reticulum is basically an organelle, or it's just, you know, it's another sort of membrane-bound body that sits inside the muscle cell, and it contains all the calcium. So you need calcium for muscle contraction, but obviously so that you don't get one sustained contraction, you need to be able to regulate calcium in and out of the cell body where you have the contracting muscle. So as you start to contract, NADPH oxidase actually increases superoxide. And what superoxide does is it increases the amount of calcium that comes out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum via something called ryanodine receptors. And it also reduces the amount of calcium that goes back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So actually, it's in one way, the generating of superoxide is really important in making sure that you get maximal and efficient muscle contraction. The problem is then if you overdo it, that's associated with fatigue.
Okay.
So there's absolutely a balance there. So you need some for good performance, but if you overdo it, then you can start to get problems with the way that see the calcium signaling happens in the cell, or another thing is that you get you affect the potassium sodium ATPase, which affects where sodium potassium are inside the cell. And the reactive oxygen species can affect that particular transporter, and you end up with lots of potassium outside the cell, which is where you don't want it. And then that's another aspect of fatigue. So then the reactive oxygen species can kind of affect that.
Okay.
And it does seem to come back to the kind of the level of training of the athlete. So the study I just talked about, you know, in the average person, you know, either the recreationally trained athlete or somebody who's trying to get fitter, then I think that's kind of that study is geared at them. Those are the kind of the weekend warrior, or you know, somebody who's looking after their health, training 2-3 times a week, or somebody who's trying to train more. And then I think that extra vitamin C and vitamin E supplementation is probably, you know, it's not going to necessarily be beneficial, and it may sort of blunt some of those effects that you're getting.
Okay. Let me just be clear about that. It sounded to me like you were saying that doing more cellular respiration doesn't necessarily increase oxidative stress. Is that right? So if I generate more energy in my mitochondria, that doesn't necessarily increase oxidative stress?
No. So if you look at the state of the mitochondria, so when they're in their kind of like standard ticking over metabolic state, that's probably the state when they're producing the most reactive oxygen species. And it seems that when you're actually in like full blown muscle contraction, actually that you're producing, you know, you actually have, you know, as long as you have, you know, properly functional mitochondria and they haven't been damaged by something, then actually you have much more efficient electron transfer through the mitochondria, and actually less of it gets passed on to oxygen to make superoxide.
So now I'm starting to think that this whole thing, like selling antioxidants to athletes, is completely bogus and we really shouldn't do it at all.
So one of the reasons I got interested in this actually is because there's a drink that's marketed, particularly in the CrossFit world, where there's a reasonable dose of vitamin C, a reasonable dose of vitamin E, and there's also some caffeine in there. And it's sold as a recovery drink. And, you know, I was just like, that's exactly the time that you don't want that, you know, but, you know, with the right sort of level of marketing, then you can kind of sell it. So absolutely. I don't think that, you know, especially in that setting, that those are the kind of things you want to be taking.
Okay. Yeah, no, super, super interesting, like how all this stuff works. I should probably point out, actually, you know, you're using a lot of fancy words there, but I already mentioned the Khan Academy chemistry. Also, Brian Walsh's Metabolic Fitness Pro, which I've mentioned more than once, like he describes all of the stuff that you've just been talking about, like at least the biochemistry and some of the physiology. The physiology class is not out yet, but the biochemistry is really what's most appropriate here. And so I think that's really useful for understanding this. And something else I wanted to say was, like, I mean, I know it's just a stupid N equals one, but those elevated markers of oxidative stress that I saw in my original organics profile, they came right back down into, so the organics test, it's divided into quintiles. So it's not, I mean, they do give you the raw data, but I'm not sure how meaningful those numbers are as standalone data points. And it's kind of like you look at the bullet, see where you are in the quintile ranking amongst healthy people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was up into the red for both of those two organic acids. And once I sorted out my gut, so got rid of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and a pinworm and whatever else, then, you know, just got healthier, less inflammation, my C-reactive protein came down. The oxidative stress came down with it, and I didn't change my training, right? Like, I still train as much as I've ever done, and maybe that's not quite true. Perhaps my plan is a little bit more minimalist, but certainly I'm racing as much as I ever have, and yeah, my oxidative stress still looks in the normal range when compared to just healthy individuals.
And I think that's absolutely, you know, that's definitely part of it. And I think that there's a real difference between the oxidative stress that you're getting from something like, and you do, you know, you're doing long races every weekend, you're doing, you know, long training sessions multiple times per week. And what people are talking about now is that is talking about exercise as an antioxidant in itself. And the reason that is because in response to all those reactive oxygen species that you make, your body upregulates all those things that then deal with the reactive oxygen species. So you get an increase in superoxide dismutase, you get an increase in glutathione production. Mm-hmm. So actually you get a natural increase in those things because your body has responded to the stress you've put on it. And then you get that sort of beneficial boost.
Right. This makes sense.
And so I think a real problem we've had in a lot of medicine and biochemistry and in sort of the world of supplementation and things is that we've assumed that, you know, just because something is bad, that we should always try and reduce it. And I think there are actually a lot of examples, particularly when it comes to something like health, but also sports performance. So things that we originally thought were bad, so inflammation. You know, everybody talks about how inflammation is associated with chronic disease, and it absolutely is if it's chronic. You know, you have that sort of low-grade inflammation the whole time. It's associated with atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease and cancer. But if you get peaks in inflammation caused by something like exercise, that reduces your overall inflammation burden the rest of the time. So, you know, one of the things that we call now a myokine. So they're basically they're signaling molecules created by muscles that go out and do stuff in the rest of the body. And one of the ones that's studied the most is IL-6, so interleukin-6, which people may have heard of because it stimulates production of CRP. And CRP is one of those things that, you know, you measure as one of your potential risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Because it's associated, you know, having a high CRP is associated with sort of like a high inflammatory burden. But if you have a peak in IL-6 because of exercise, what that does is it actually modulates the receptors for IL-6, and then overall your inflammatory burden reduces. So the rest of the time you have a lower inflammatory burden. And a very similar thing, and one of the downstream effects of that, people might have heard of a transcription factor called NF-kappa-B. Have you heard of that?
I have, vaguely. I have no idea what it does, though.
And people talk about it a lot, and it's because it does, like, it's literally associated with half of the processes in the body where you're activating a gene, or, you know, activating the, you know, the creation of a protein or an enzyme or something. And I've seen some people say that you should do this and this to reduce your NF-kappa-B expression. But NF-kappa-B is increased after exercise, and it's part of the inflammatory response. So chronically elevated NF-kappa-B expression, you know, or activation in your cells is absolutely associated with that chronic inflammation. But if you get an increase in NF-kappa-B directly after exercise, then that is associated with all those kind of adaptations. So you get things like more glutathione, and you get more mitochondrial biogenesis. So you start to activate and make more of the proteins that then go into your mitochondria, and then what they do is they get bigger and then they split. So you have mitochondrial fission. So then you have more mitochondria and you can produce more energy and you're more energy efficient. So if you're blocking that inflammatory response, and you know, this is a whole other podcast. So like if you take something like ibuprofen or naproxen, then after exercise, then again you dampen down that inflammatory response and you don't get those sort of beneficial downstream effects of that kind of peak of inflammation. And there's you know, a very similar thing is recently found out with cortisol. We always think that, you know, high cortisol can be a bad thing, but, you know, if you're looking at sports performance or, you know, guys in the gym trying to put on muscle, those who have a big cortisol peak after exercise, they tend to put on the most muscle. So you get that cortisol peak, you get that stress increase, and then you get a lower level the rest of the time. And you see the same thing in something like obesity and diabetes. So they're both associated with an increase in sort of chronic cortisol levels. But if you get people exercising, then you get a peak in cortisol because of the stress of exercise. And then your sort of basal, your resting level of cortisol decreases the rest of the time. So these kind of peaks of stress are something that can be really beneficial to the body because of the way you then adapt to it. And if you stop that happening, then you stop getting those beneficial effects.
Do you know, the best example I can think of for this that everybody will understand is going out into the sun, right? So I used to live in the East Bay here in Northern California, and there's no trees. You know, I'd ride around on my road bike in the sun, and by this time of year, I would look like, you know, somebody of like Greek descent or something. I'd have a really good suntan, and I wouldn't even think about it. And now we've moved into the redwood trees here in Santa Cruz. I don't really get as much. It is very sunny and hot here, but there's not as much sun exposure. And so I don't have that base tan like I normally would at this time of year. And of course, I go out into the sun, and if I'm not careful, I get fried. And it's just, that's a normal, you know, hormetic response to the sun. Is that's what your body does. And yeah, it's kind of a similar situation, I think, with suntan cream. If you like slather your body in factor 50 or factor 99 or whatever the hell it is they sell here in the US, and never get any sun exposure, then, you know, guess what? You're blocking that response, that you're blocking the process of getting stronger.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that you should go out and get burnt in the same way. It's not to say you should go out and like chronically elevate cortisol as much as you possibly can. There's like a balance to strike here.
Absolutely.
So I think I'll end it there. Obviously, this has been quite dense. I thank you so much for all this really technical information. I'm probably going to go back and listen to this one myself, and then maybe rewatch some of the videos from Brian, because I think he does a really good job of describing this biochemistry in front of his whiteboard. And then, like I say, the Khan Academy chemistry is really handy as well. And so it seems like if we were to create a prescriptive at the end of this interview, it would be to do not take antioxidant supplements just because you read about it in a magazine or a friend told you about it. Really, the only way to know whether your oxidative stress is chronically elevated is to test. And even then, it still might not be a good idea to take antioxidants. Do you think that's fair to say?
Well, I think for some people, they can absolutely be beneficial. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people, if they have gut inflammation or, you know, some people, if you're talking about problems with the gut and then something like histamine intolerance, something like that, then, you know, some kind of autoimmune disease, potentially with some gut involvement, then I think antioxidants can potentially be beneficial. And that's if you're seeing those chronically elevated markers of oxidative stress.
Right. So yeah, it's a further prescription. I should probably, you know, so Dr. Jamie Bush is my medical director, and we've talked about this quite a lot, and we've gone back and forwards on which is the best supplement. At the moment, we're settled on N-acetylcysteine, actually, as a glutathione precursor. So rather than trying to load you up full of things which are able to donate electrons directly, we're giving you this amino acid, which I think most of the studies agree is the main rate limiting step in the production of glutathione. And so you can just give your body more of what it needs in order to produce the molecule that's helping out with the chronic inflammation. And I mean, we never really know like whether there's a true cause and effect when we redo tests, but it does seem to be helping, or something we're doing is helping, and the biochemistry makes sense.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, so N-acetylcysteine, NAC, is one of them, like actually one of the other best studied supplements in terms of sports performance. And for that exact reason, because you're giving a glutathione donor, which can then sort of balance some of that reactive oxygen species.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I would say about it's such a tricky supplement, N-acetylcysteine, it tends to oxidize very easily, and you have to watch for it. You know, like I'll mention it to someone, and then they'll go buy a bag of bulk powder from, I want to name any names, but some company on the internet, and they're like, oh god, do I have to keep taking that? It stinks like eggs. And it's because
and people often, you know, you get quite bad farts, a lot of people actually. That's what I hear a lot of complaints about, actually.
I think that's a clear sign. So originally I was selling a supplement called Pharmanac, which is N-acetylcysteine, that comes in a blister pack, and so it can't oxidize, and then you drop it into a glass of water and it turns into an effervescent drink. And so it doesn't really get a chance to oxidize like a powder certainly would. And, you know, I think the capsules are somewhat airtight, but I've heard reports of even the capsules stinking like sulfur if they've been, you know, left around for long enough.
Yeah, that's, it's just, and it's because the cysteine in the NAC is a sulfur based compound, and that's what you're smelling. Is you're smelling the the sulfur.
Right, so. That's the breakdown. So hopefully this has been useful to people. I mean, my advice would be I'm going to keep doing the organic acids test. And then what other markers? Is there anything cheaper that you know of that you can test for? What about uric acid on a blood chemistry? Do you think that's useful for?
I think that's really difficult. It's not something that people traditionally look at. I mean, what they've traditionally looked at is various breakdown products of fats and proteins and DNA. So, so that's stuff like your 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. I don't know, in terms of like a direct measure that's sort of cheap and easy, I'm not sure actually.
Okay. I'm always looking for things, you know, these tests are so goddamn expensive. It's $370 for this urine test. And you know, the blood chemistry is $26, and I can't see any obvious reason why one should be cheaper than the other. Maybe I don't know enough about the way that the tests are done, but I'm sure it's just a question of quantity, right? They do a lot more basic blood chemistries than they do these organic acids tests. So,
and it's also how expensive the machine was to buy, and then they have to, you know, justify paying for it, and you know how difficult they are to work and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Tommy. I really appreciate this.
No problem.